This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with author Matt Meyer about his latest book, White Lives Matter Most.
Subtitled, and Other Little White Lies. Listen in. We're going to learn about both.
We'll also speak with author and attorney Angela Davis.
We're going to talk to her about the power of prosecutors, most of whom are white.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. In a society in which entrenched racism persists, is it possible for white activists to meaningfully engage in anti-racist movements like the Movement for Black Lives? Longtime peace activist, educator, and author Matt Meyer examines that question in his new book, White Lives Matter Most, and Other, quote, Little White Lies. As we honor the life and legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., we talk today with Matt Meyer, of whom Cornel West says, quote, this legendary freedom fighter brings together the best of the peace movement and the best of the anti-racism movement. Matt Meyer, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Always a pleasure to be here.
Congratulations on your latest publication. The book is called White Lives Matter Most, with a very small subtitle that says, And Other Little White Lies. I've heard tell that this is the kind of book one cannot read on the New York subway.
Well, yeah. One reviewer said he really liked the content, but having a book that screams out White Lives Matter Most is not the best or safest thing to have here in the Big Apple. I've been saying everywhere I go, this is not an aspirational title. This is actually a provocative title that's trying to be a descriptive history of what the U.S. has been, not what we want it to be.
We are joined in our studio today by our friend and colleague, Mitty Owens, who, along with you, Matt, is on the board of the A.J. Musty Institute. Mitty, you've recently read the book.
Well, Matt, I think it's wonderful to put this out there. I'm most curious how it's being received by your white colleagues in the movement. Where, and not the easy responses, where's the greatest pushback and maybe even subtle tension?
Well, I think it's a complicated moment in U.S. history. I think it's a complicated moment to look at identity and identity politics. So I think there are two answers to that. There are two areas of pushback, especially from white activists and white organizers. One is sort of a, oh, yeah, that's important, but it's not us. And I think that's part of the issue. Dennis Brutus, an old colleague and close friend, South African poet, went back home a few years after the end of political apartheid, a few years after 1984. And he said, you know, Matt, the strangest thing, I spoke to lots and lots of white people throughout South Africa, and none of them ever supported apartheid. It's extraordinary. They were all against it. I don't know how it lasted so long. And so I think that's one of the pushbacks from certain colleagues within the U.S. left and within the progressive movement, white folks who say, well, this is all good and well, but we've been doing anti-racist work for X number of years, and we've been doing anti-racist work in this way and in that way. And there's no question that there are some emerging and new organizations, and there is good work going on. But I think part of what we try to say in this book, part of what I try to say in the message that several of us are trying to put out through this work, is it's not just about anti-racist action. It's about an analysis and an understanding of the empire at this moment, an empire in decline, that in addition to having racist policies, also is deeply colonial in its relationship to black folk, in its relationship, obviously, to Puerto Ricans and Mexican people, Chicanos. It's an empire that looks at colonizing peoples, nations, and cultures. And that looking beyond simply an anti-racist but to an anti-imperialist analysis is necessary.
We're going to broadcast this interview with you on Martin Luther King Day. And I wanted to ask you, what's the connection between what organizing King was doing 51 years ago and the Black Lives Matter movement?
Well, I want to say beyond even the movement for Black Lives, the key, I think, of King's last major campaign, the Poor People's Campaign, is that it was a campaign that understood the need for the leadership of groups like Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the need for the leadership from the South, from Black-led organizations and organizing, but also the need to cross all racial lines, the need for a class analysis that looks at what poor and working people had to unite around. And that's a connection that still hasn't been done, that still needs to be done today. And in fact, though this is in many ways spotlighted as King's last great unfinished campaign, King's own analysis around race and class was there years and years before 1968. And so we have some important radical roots of King and of our own struggles to get back to.
And Matt, are you hopeful about sort of the, particularly some of the young organizers of today in terms of making, really recognizing that intersectionality? You know, some of the groups that Musty has, the A.J. Musty Foundation has funded, have been groups among Arab American youth, you know, youth of color and various groups and gay lesbian groups, and they seem to really be very impressive in making some of these connections. It seems like maybe there's a new day at people really recognizing that solidarity and doing the work. I'm wondering what your impression is of those linkages being made.
Well, I have to say I am, and this is very difficult for me to say in general and on the air, I am less optimistic than I used to be. I'm very worried about this moment. Yes, everything you said, Mitty, is correct. There are more organizations, there are more groups and grouplets springing up. Mainly, I think, yes, from within oppressed communities and nations and groups. So in that sense, there's reason for some hope. On the other hand, I am less optimistic about so-called white America. I have to think, when I think about King, also about one of the young leaders of the time, Stokely Carmichael, of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, later to rename himself Kwame Ture. And, you know, we talk about 67, 68, and the Atlanta project of SNCC and the gauntlet that they threw down for white folk not to leave the movement and not to leave the organizations that were working together hand in hand, but to focus deeply on work within the white community, work against racism, against colonialism, against the evils of U.S. society. And this actually, you know, speaks to an earlier book of mine that was co-edited with Mandy Carter and Elizabeth Petita Martinez, which was titled We Have Not Been Moved. And that title comes from a sad and worrisome analysis that gauntlet that was thrown down in 66 and 67 and 68 for white folk to pick up the work has not moved very far in these 50 plus years.
One thing, though, that is changed for the better is this. One of the facts of King's life that isn't that well known is that, indeed, he was a socialist. He was a democratic socialist. And the kind of programs that he was advocating are the kind of programs we need then and now. And I think that understanding, openness to social ideas now, is much better than it was 50 years ago. Wouldn't you agree?
I think there are waves. So certainly some socialist organizations have membership numbers that are better than they were 50 years ago. But, you know, King was close to many figures in socialist movements and communist movements. But first and foremost, he was a preacher. He was a transcendental thinker. And as a whole, I do feel like in terms of movements, we were better 50 years ago. I don't think it was a special thing about organizers who had greater perceptions. I don't think it was a thing about a special moment of the 60s. But I think we have had a hard time tying together some of those good ideas that you're correctly talking about, Michael, and making them into actual movements.
Yeah, Matt, I just pick up on a couple of thoughts. The, you know, I think about how King himself admonished the white community in his final book, Where Do We Go From Here, and not addressing really forthrightly white racism and its, you know, assumption of privilege and entitlement, and that sort of voice of conscience pushing us to constantly reflect, go deeper, and build that solidarity. We truly need that. I think of Reverend William Barber, someone who is picking up that mantle. Are there some other individuals, although I know, of course, this goes beyond individuals, or other particular lights, movements, individuals, that you see as really pushing this? And hopefully this book is one of those lights.
Wow, thank you for that compliment. And this is not a scripted piece, even though many, you and I do work together with the A.J. Mustey Institute. That question is one I almost was in my mind thinking, ooh, I hope someone asks me about that. Because as much as I've worked with and Fellowship of Reconciliation, which I'm the national co-chair of, you know, played a role with Reverend Dr. William Barber and Reverend Liz Theo Harris in the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, another name, another leading light, and another organizational space, which I think is deeply authentic and deeply important, is the work coming out of Ferguson, and that's been developing and deepening in Ferguson over the last years. The Truth-Telling Project is an organization to look at because they're understanding that the need to put the truth of what U.S. society is about on the table before social change can occur. And specifically, one of the founders of that group, David Raglan, who's a close colleague, is a co-author. He's actually the lead co-author of two of the articles featured in this book. He's also a leading reparations activist. He's a Bayard Rustin senior scholar. He's one of the staff people of the Fellowship of Reconciliation. So I'd say David Raglan and the Truth Telling Project fit that question you asked rather perfectly.
Great.
Matt, we all love the title of your book, White Lives Matter Most and Other Little White Lies. And I wanted to ask you, tell us about some of the other little white lies, please.
By the way, since this is radio, we have to say the word little is in quotes, just to be clear about that. Well, I think a close friend of mine who is known, I think, to many of the listeners of Law and Disorder, political prisoner David Gilbert, talks about the wink. He talks about growing up in white society, that in some ways when he heard about democracy and he heard about the land of the free and the home of the brave, what he didn't get as a young man growing up with liberal parents in Massachusetts, that there was a wink at the end of that that meant for us, not for everyone. And I think that's in some ways one of the, quote, little, actually very, very big fundamental lies about what the U.S. is and isn't.
Any other little white lies?
Many others, but you tell me we don't have enough time for all of them on the show.
That's one of the problems with politics in this country.
Well, we are indeed running out of time. I wanted to tell our listeners that this book is published by PM Press. It has a foreword by Sonia Sanchez. It's a small book, but big in ideas, and we know that our listeners will really enjoy this.
Well, thanks to all of you. Thanks again to David Raglan, the lead author of two of the chapters of the book. Thanks to Professor Anna Lopez of Ostis College, who is the lead author of another chapter. And, of course, it would have been impossible to conceive of this work without the great Sonia Sanchez, who not only contributed to the foreword, but also has been one of the inspiring figures for all of us. It's people like Sonia who understand how to build movements, how to connect peoples, how to work for justice with peace that I think continues to inspire me and should inspire all of us.
Matt, by the way, is current national co-chair of the Fellowship of Reconciliation and former chair of the War Resisters League. He's on the A.J. Mustey Board of Directors and author of several books. And Matt's latest book is published by PM Press. Be sure to get it. Matt, Mitty, thank you so much. Best of luck with the book. And we'll talk to you soon.
You take it easy, Matt. Thanks for helping us out here, Mitty.
Sure, peace.
In the halls of justice, it has been quipped, the only justice you find is in the halls. H. Rapp Brown, a leader of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, said that justice in America means just us. There are 2.3 million people in American prisons today. A great proportion of them are African Americans. If you assume Europe has the same social situation that we do in America, it's a telling fact that we have seven times as many prisoners. Part of the explanation for this phenomena, in addition to the racist nature of the USA, is the power that the American prosecutor has. It is the power to choose whom to prosecute and for what crime. It is the power to obtain convictions, not to seek justice. It is a power that is discretionary and often open to abuse. This abuse is rarely reviewable or punished. We speak today with attorney and law professor Angela J. Davis. She's the author of Arbitrary Justice, The Power of the American Prosecutor. Her most recent book, Policing the Black Man, covers the key issues of the Black Lives Matter movement. Attorney Davis is a professor of law at American University's Washington College of Law, where she teaches criminal law and criminal procedure. Prior to her career as a law professor, Davis was a public defender at the Public Defender Service for the District of Columbia before becoming the agency's director. Angela J. Davis, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Angela, a lot of people think that police officers are the most powerful figures in the criminal justice system, but it's the prosecutors, isn't it? And why is this so?
Well, you know, I'm really happy about the fact that people pay so much attention to police officers. Of course, we must pay attention to police officers. They have a tremendous amount of power, a tremendous amount of discretion to stop people, search people on the street, and as we know from all of the attention with the recent killings of young black men, even use deadly force against individuals. So that attention to police officers' power and discretion is warranted and should continue. But I contend that prosecutors are actually the most powerful officials in the criminal justice system, and that's because although police officers have the power to bring an individual to the courthouse door, it's the prosecutor who has the power to decide whether that person remains in the court, becomes firmly entrenched in the court, and determines exactly what happens to that individual because of their tremendous charging and plea bargaining powers, which really determine the outcome of all criminal cases.
How do they get their jobs?
Prosecutors, depends on whether you're talking about a state prosecutor or a federal prosecutor.
Both.
I pay a lot of attention to state prosecutors because some people say as much as 99% of all criminal cases are actually handled on the state level, not on the federal level. And state prosecutors in the vast majority of states are actually elected officials. In all but four or five jurisdictions, they run for office every 2 or 4 years, just like other officials, but people don't really pay attention to prosecutor races. They are called district attorneys in some states. They are called state's attorneys in others. But oftentimes they run unopposed. They serve for decades. There are no term limits. And people don't pay attention to these races. And it's unfortunate because they are the most powerful officials in our criminal justice system, and we need to pay attention to them and hold them accountable in the democratic process. But unfortunately, that doesn't happen very often. It's changing a little bit, but it hasn't been happening over the years, which is why they've been able to get away with so much power and discretion, and many of them actually abuse that power and discretion, which is quite unfortunate.
Yeah, well, I want to get into that with you, but before I ask you that, I wanted to know if you know what percentage of prosecutors are African Americans.
So when we're talking about prosecutors, we're talking about the chief prosecutor. So just a bit about how it works. The elected official, who's called either a state's attorney or a district attorney, that person is in charge of their entire office of prosecutors, and they have the power to hire the prosecutors in their office. So if you're talking about what percentage of chief district attorneys or state's attorneys are African American, it's probably less than 2%. You know, the vast majority, something like 98% of chief prosecutors are white males. Very few women, very few people of color.
How do these prosecutors get the cases that they handle?
So the way that most prosecutors get the cases is through police officers making arrests on the street. So, you know, let's give an example. You know, someone is robbed, they call the police. The police officer comes. If they're able to identify the person who robbed them, the police officer arrests that person, brings the person to the courthouse, and then they recommend to the prosecutor whether that person should be charged or not. And a lot of people talk about how police officers charge you with a crime. Police officers don't have that power. It's the prosecutor. And it's usually through the person being arrested on the street. That's how the way it usually happens, particularly with run-of-the-mill crimes. Now, with white-collar crimes and other kinds of offenses, a lot of times the prosecutors initiate the charging process by investigating the person through a grand jury or so forth, and then the arrest is made afterwards. But usually it's an arrest and a recommendation to the prosecutor, which they can either take or leave. They can take the recommendation of the police officer, or they can decide not to. The prosecutor can decide, I'm going to charge you with whatever the police officer recommended, or they can decide to charge them with something greater or something less, or they can decide not to charge them at all. And all, that power is all in the hands of the prosecutor. That decision is made behind closed doors with no transparency. And that's how they get away with, you know, a lot of the misconduct and a lot of the disparate charging where some people are charged and others aren't. Sometimes it plays out based on race and class, and that's how we oftentimes end up with a lot of these race and class disparities that we have in our criminal justice system today because of decisions made by prosecutors.
Professor Davis, in your book, Arbitrary Justice, The Power of the American Prosecutor, you write about four significant points in the prosecutorial mm-hmm. process: the initial screening, the charging, plea officers, and then the final disposition. Let's discuss these. How do prosecutors mm-hmm. make decisions on whom to prosecute?
Mm-hmm. So the way it works, that's why it's interesting, because the title of my book is Arbitrary Justice for a reason. A lot of times it appears that the decisions they make are arbitrary, which is frightening when you think about it, because they have the power to take away a person's liberty and even their lives in states that have the death penalty. But the way it works is, and I'll give you, let me just give an example to sort of illustrate my point. Let's say a police officer arrests a person, and that person has 5 bags of cocaine on them at the time. And the police officer, let's say, brings the person to the courthouse and to the prosecutor and says, I recommend that you charge this person with possession with intent to distribute cocaine. Now, in most states, that particular charge is a very serious felony that carries a mandatory minimum sentence of as much as 10 years in some jurisdictions. So if that person is charged with 5 counts, each of which carries a mandatory 5-10 years in prison, let's say, they're facing 50 years in prison. Now, and let's say the prosecutor listens to the police officer and says, you know, I don't think I'm going to charge this person with that. I think I'll just charge them with possession of cocaine, which they have every right to do. Even if they have probable cause, which is all they need to charge the person, or even if they have the proof beyond a reasonable doubt that they need to convict them ultimately at trial, they can simply decide to just charge them with possession just because they want to, right? And there may be good reasons. I'm not saying they shouldn't do that. Maybe they say, I'm going to give this person a break because this person is a first offender. Or, you know, maybe they think they don't have enough evidence to prove the felony at trial. So there may be good reasons why they're doing it, but sometimes there aren't good reasons. Maybe they know the lawyer, the family. Maybe the person's from a well-to-do family. And maybe that family has a lawyer who knows the prosecutor and comes and talks to the prosecutor and says, give this kid a break. You know, he's college-bound. Let's not ruin his life. And along those lines, the prosecutor could even decide not to charge that person at all. They can just dismiss the charges. all together, right? So you can see how these decisions, which are made behind closed doors, can produce disparities. Because if there's one defendant who maybe is well off, well connected, you know, has, you know, connections, that person may get a break. Whereas another kid who maybe is poor from a, you know, a neighborhood, or, you know, sort of not well off, maybe that person's, you know, an African American kid, and the prosecutor has no empathy for that person, and then that person might get charged with a felony. And so that's how these race and class disparities happen at that stage of the process. And I don't suggest that they're intentional necessarily. Sometimes they may be. I think a lot of it is implicit bias, unconscious racism, unconscious classism, where they look and see one person and they see the humanity in that person, and they decide to give that person a break, whereas the other person, they look at them and they see a criminal, a thug, and they don't care and they charge them. You know, and so it's and these decisions, because they happen behind closed doors, because, you know, it can't be proven that they're racist decisions, because oftentimes they are not intentionally racist decisions. Oftentimes it's unconscious racism. It's a very complex problem, and it ends up producing these disparities. But that's just the charging step. You mentioned also the plea bargaining stage.
Yes.
A lot of people think, you know, they watch these, you know, various versions of Law and Order on television. I think there are probably 6 or 7 versions, and you see all these trials going on TV, and a lot of people unfortunately get their impressions of the criminal justice system from watching television. They think there are all these trials going on in our criminal courts. Not so. There are very few trials going on. Very few people exercise their right to trial. 95, sometimes some figures go as high as 98% of all criminal cases are resolved with a guilty plea. 98% of people are pleading guilty. And here's why it happens. It's because of the power of prosecutors. In the example that I just gave of the individual who, let's say it's the prosecutor decides they're going to charge this person with 5 counts of the felony, a cocaine offense. They're facing 50 years in prison. The prosecutor says, tell you what, I'll make you a deal. I'll allow you to plead guilty to one of those felonies, and I'll dismiss the other 4 if you plead guilty. You give up your right to trial, you give up your right to appeal, but if you go to trial, it's risky business because you never know what a jury's going to do. Even if you have a good defense, that jury might come back with guilty. And the reality is that the majority of people have overworked public defenders who don't have the resources in their offices to investigate the cases. And prosecutors will go to that public defender, offer the plea, and sometimes I've been in situations, I've seen or heard of situations in which prosecutors will put a deadline on the plea. They'll say to the defense attorney, I'll give your guy a deal. He can plead guilty to this one felony, but you've got to give me an answer by 5 o'clock today or the deal is off. And the poor defense attorney might say, look, I haven't had a chance to investigate the case. My client may have a defense. It's my ethical duty to do so. And the prosecutor just says, too bad. Take it or leave it by 5. And you can see the horrible position that puts the defense attorney in. He goes to his client and he says, look, you might have a defense, you know, but I'm not going to have the opportunity to investigate it. And you got this deal presented to you, and if you turn it down, they're not going to give it back to you again. So you can see the pressure, how even innocent people might plead guilty because they're afraid to go to trial and face the prospect of spending the rest of their lives in prison. And that is what passes as justice in American courts today. And it's an outrage, and it's because of the tremendous power that prosecutors have at the charging and plea bargaining stages. And to top it off, those decisions are made behind closed doors with no transparency. I mean, we live in a democracy which is supposed to be based on transparency and holding our elected officials accountable. But when it comes to prosecutors, the system just simply is not working.
What about the end of the process, the final disposition?
Yeah. So sentencing, right? So prosecutors have a whole lot of power at that stage. And honestly, you know, when you're talking about mandatory minimum sentences, and a bit what that means is that the legislatures on both the state and the federal level have passed these awful laws that basically say if a person's convicted of this crime, there's a mandatory minimum amount of time they must spend in prison. And unfortunately, they've passed a lot of those mandatory minimum laws for drug offenses, nonviolent drug offenses, where people are facing 10 mandatory years in prison. And what that means is that if they have that conviction, if they're convicted after trial or if they plead guilty to a mandatory minimum, the judge has absolutely no discretion. The judge, even if the judge says, I don't think it's fair for this first offender to spend 10 years in prison when they have no record, you know, they played a minor role, I really don't want to put this person in prison, but they don't have a choice because it's a mandatory minimum offense. So really the power, again, even at the stage of sentencing, is in the hands of the prosecutor because they're the ones who decided to charge that person with that offense. They made a plea bargain that the person accepted. So they have a lot of power at sentencing. Even when there's not a mandatory minimum offense, judges tend to listen to prosecutors, and oftentimes they will ask for harsh penalties for nonviolent offenses, which is, you know, just an outrage considering that, you know, this nation has the highest incarceration rate in the world, with 2.3 million people in its prisons and jails, way out of step with every other nation with whom we associate ourselves in Western countries. So it's indeed a crisis, and I lay a lot of the blame at the feet, at the foot of prosecutors.
Jumping back to the beginning of it all with the probable cause, the cops arrest mm-hmm. people because there's probable cause, that's a really low standard, isn't it?
It is a very low standard. So probable cause basically means it's more probable than not that the person committed the offense. It's the standard that police officers use to arrest an individual. It's a very, very low standard. It's the same standard in the grand jury when grand juries are deciding whether to bring an indictment. More probable than not. So it takes very little for a prosecutor to bring charges, which is why a lot of them pile on charges. They bring all these charges that they know they can't prove at trial. The standard to prove a person guilty at trial is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. You can't get a conviction before a jury unless you prove that person's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. So it's really easy for prosecutors to pile on all these charges at the beginning, right, because all they have to show is probable cause to bring the charges. The defendant is looking at all of these offenses. Maybe the prosecutor can't prove many of them or maybe not any of them at trial, but it's daunting and they're afraid of what a jury might do at trial, and so that's why people feel so much pressure to plead guilty.
And grand juries, that's another route for a prosecutor to get somebody in the dock. Mm-hmm. Grand juries mm-hmm. are notorious for being object of manipulation by the prosecutor. I remember that famous quip during the Watergate trial where they said that a prosecutor would get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't know why they use a ham sandwich, but that's
funny.
The thing. That's the saying, a grand jury will indict a ham sandwich, because grand juries are totally controlled by prosecutors. Here's how it works. People are called to serve on the grand jury. It's different from being, you know, asked to serve on an actual petite jury, as they call them, for a trial where they're deciding a person's guilt. Usually it's between 20 and 30 individuals. They're called to sit, you know, to do grand jury duty. Oftentimes they serve for about a month or two, and they hear case after case after case. And the only individual they hear from is the prosecutor, The only lawyer they hear from is the prosecutor. The only side of the stories they hear from is the side of the prosecutor. The prosecutor presents all of her witnesses, and of course all of the witnesses that the prosecutor presents are going to be witnesses that are going to favor the prosecutor. They don't present the other side of the story. The defense attorney does not have the right to be there, does not have the right to present any evidence. Of course, the defendant doesn't have the right to be present. So grand juries only hear one side of the story. Now, a good ethical prosecutor would present exculpatory evidence, evidence that is on the side of the defendant, if the prosecutor has that evidence. They would, if they're trying to be fair, they would give the grand jury both sides of the story. But there's actually a Supreme Court case that says they don't have to. They don't have to present exculpatory evidence at the grand jury stage. And so they don't, because they're trying to get a conviction. And so course, when grand jurors are only hearing one side of the story, they're going to come back with indictments. It's very, very easy for a grand jury to return an indictment because the standard is so low and they only hear one side of the story, which is why it's so ridiculous that, and I know we may talk about this later, so ridiculous that so many of these police officers who were charged, most of them weren't charged with these killings of young black men that have happened in recent years, but even those that were charged, I mean, no indictments were brought in the vast majority of them, which is a little ridiculous because it's really easy to return an indictment, but the prosecutors are controlling the process, and so they don't want the police officer to be indicted. They're not going to get indicted. Bring back to my point, they control the grand jury entirely.
Yeah, and getting convictions is a lot different from getting justice, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, the Supreme Court, in a famous case called Berger versus United States said, and I'm paraphrasing, it's not the role of the prosecutor to seek convictions. It's the role of the prosecutor to seek justice. And justice sometimes means a conviction, but justice sometimes means not charging the person at all. And far too few prosecutors understand that role and take it seriously, unfortunately.
Let's get back to the differences in plea offers, depending on whether a defendant is white or black or young or old or educated or charged with a violent crime or has a prior record. How do these factors figure in?
It's very complicated, right? It's a complicated process. So the American Bar Association has set these, what they call standards for the prosecution function. And what they are, they're sort of guidelines that the American Bar Association would like prosecutors to follow when they're making charging and plea bargaining decisions. Factors that they believe prosecutors should consider in deciding whether to charge a person or whether to offer a plea. And there are factors like, the strength of the evidence. If the evidence is really strong, you should be more inclined to charge. If it's not strong, you shouldn't. Another is the interest of the victim in prosecution, right? If the victim really wants to go forward with the case, that shouldn't necessarily determine your decision, prosecutor, but you should take that into account when making the decision. If they don't want to go forward, maybe you shouldn't go forward with the case. So that's another factor. Whether the defendant has a record or not, of course that should be taken into account. You're more inclined to give a break to someone who's a first offender than someone who has a long criminal history. But all of those factors, which appear to be race-neutral and class-neutral, actually aren't. And so I'll give you an example. Let's say you have a case where a prosecutor is trying to decide, whether to charge an individual with burglary. And let's say the victim is a poor black woman who lives in, public housing, and her apartment was burglarized, and, some of her jewelry was taken, her television, and so on. She calls the police, and, an arrest is made, and so the prosecutor is then, going forward with the case. And so the prosecutor then sends a notice to the victim's home asking her to appear to testify in the grand jury and be interviewed to prepare for trial. And let's say the victim doesn't show up. And so the prosecutor is like, okay, well, she's not showing up. She must not be interested in prosecution, so I'll just dismiss the case. And so the case gets dismissed. Well, there may be many reasons why this victim didn't show up. Maybe she didn't show up because she does day work and she can't afford to take off from work to go down to a prosecutor's office or she'll lose her job. Or maybe she didn't get the mail at all because she lives in a building where her mail is stolen, right? Or maybe she didn't show up because she's afraid to go down to the prosecutor's office because this is the same prosecutor who prosecuted her son and she's feeling intimidated. So she might have been interested in prosecution, but she didn't show up for reasons that have nothing to do with that, and the prosecutor dismisses the case. Does that mean that the prosecutor is being racist towards that victim? Well, actually, no, because he didn't know all those things. He's got a busy calendar, so he moves on. Or maybe she does show up. Let's say she does show up, and she's not well-dressed, and she's not speaking the Queen's English, and, just doesn't present well, according to the prosecutor, as a witness. And so he thinks, I don't want to put her on the stand because if I put her on the stand, I'm not likely to get a conviction anyway, and so I'm just going to dismiss the case. Is that being racist? Maybe it is. You know, maybe that is being racist. But the American Bar Association said that one of the factors that should be taken into account in deciding whether to bring charges is the likelihood of getting a conviction. So he's decided he can't get a conviction, even though the reasons may be based on his racial bias. So as you can see, this is complicated. But then again, it could be very straightforward, where the prosecutor is just, you know, exhibiting racism or classism. I've been talking about victims so far because, you know, as you can see, there's this discrimination against victims based on race and class as well as defendants. Let's say we're talking about a defendant and whether a prosecutor is going to charge a defendant. The example I gave earlier of someone being arrested and caught with 5 bags of cocaine. Let's say one defendant is caught with 5 bags of cocaine in his, you know, let's say it's a white kid who's selling dope at his school. And, you know, he's, you know, college bound, got a, you know, well-off family. His lawyer comes in and says, you know, don't ruin this kid's life. He's got a future ahead of him. Please dismiss the charges. He's got a drug habit, and his parents are going to put him in a drug program. If he completes that drug program, please dismiss the charges. The prosecutor says, you know what, that sounds like a fair thing. He's a first offender, and I remember back in the day I used to do a few drugs myself, and if I'd been caught, I wouldn't even be a prosecutor today. So he's not saying this out loud, but he's thinking this, right? He's, you know, he's relating to this kid, and he wants to show empathy. Well, you know what, I have no problem with that. I think that's fine. The problem is that when another kid comes in, Jamal, who lives, you know, in public housing and is caught selling drugs on the street and is a high school dropout, when his lawyer comes and asks for the same deal and his parents can't put him in a drug program even though he has a drug problem, the prosecutor says, oh, too bad, I'm just going to charge you with the felony. And, you know, he doesn't see the same humanity in Jamal because you can't really relate to him. And I don't even think it's a conscious thing. A lot of times I don't even think they're aware of what they're doing. It's something called implicit bias, which we all suffer from. Every human being suffers from implicit bias. That is the views that we all carry unconsciously based on race, class, gender, sexual orientation, body size, we all suffer from this implicit bias. We're not even aware that we're responding to a person based on their race or their gender, and we're acting on those feelings. Well, it's terrible for any of us to have implicit bias, but when someone as powerful as a prosecutor is making decisions about life and liberty based on that bias, it's more than terrible. It's unconscionable. As you can see, it's really complicated the way that these disparities come about, and they come about for different reasons, but whatever the reasons are, it's unacceptable that we have a criminal justice system with these unwarranted race and class disparities.
We're talking to attorney Professor Angela J. Davis, who has written the excellent book, Arbitrary Justice, The Power of the American Prosecutor, and she's also recently edited a book called Policing the Black Man, another wonderful book. I recommend both to our audience. Angela, is overcharging, when prosecutors overcharge, that's a problem, isn't it? And more generally, what other kinds of misconduct prosecutors get away with?
Yeah, so prosecutorial misconduct is a huge problem in our criminal justice system. And actually, surprisingly, overcharging is actually not even considered misconduct. It's a phenomenon that is unfair, that occurs, but it has not been defined as misconduct by the Supreme Court.
Amazing.
Amazing, I agree. One of the things I discuss in my book, Arbitrary Justice, is there's actually just one chapter in the book on prosecutorial misconduct. The rest of the book is about the legal actions that prosecutors take every day that, despite the fact that they're legal, actually create horrible injustices in our criminal justice system. One of the most common forms of prosecutorial misconduct in our system is what's called a Brady violation. It's named after a case called Maryland versus Brady, decided by the United States Supreme Court back in the 60s. And in that case, the Supreme Court held that prosecutors have a constitutional obligation to turn over exculpatory information to the defense. In other words, if the prosecutor knows of some information that would tend to help the defense, that would tend to show that the defendant is not guilty, they are required to not only reveal that information, but to turn it over to the defense so that it can be brought out at trial. Well, this is a huge problem in our criminal justice system. Brady violations are responsible for is one of the leading causes of wrongful convictions. For example, you hear about all these cases where people have served 30 and 40 years and then DNA shows that they're innocent. A lot of those wrongful convictions are caused by prosecutors who failed to turn over exculpatory evidence. That is one of the biggest problems in our criminal justice system, is the failure of prosecutors to reveal Brady. And it's a huge problem. And part of the problem is that the Supreme Court has set the standard so low, it didn't really give a good remedy for Brady violations. I mean, what happens if a prosecutor violates this constitutional obligation? There are a lot of things that could happen to the prosecutor. One is that they should be referred to bar counsel, and that's the disciplinary process for lawyers when lawyers violate their ethical duties, because it's also an ethical duty of a prosecutor in the rules of professional responsibility that they turn over Brady information. So they could get referred to bar counsel, and bar counsel could decide to discipline them by suspending their license or even disbarring them, but it never, ever happens. Judges rarely, anyone can actually refer a person to bar counsel, refer a prosecutor to bar counsel, but usually it's going to be the judge who discovers it, but very few judges. Very few. They almost never refer prosecutors to bar counsel. So they're not even held accountable for those violations in ways that they should. Ironically, the only prosecutor I know who was disbarred for violating Brady was Mike Nifong, who was the prosecutor in the Duke lacrosse case, if you may recall that case some years ago.
Well.
Yes, and so that case where these white, very well-off white kids, lacrosse players at Duke, were accused of raping this black woman. There was Brady information. There was actually DNA that showed that they were most likely innocent, that they did not commit the rape, and the prosecutor didn't turn the information over. Well, the only way it was discovered was because these kids had excellent lawyers. They had a team of lawyers who were able to, they had the resources to comb through, like, all of this really complicated DNA evidence that most people can't even understand, and the defense discovered it only because they had the resources to do that, and they brought it forth. What criminal defendant in criminal courts did they have that has those resources? None. You know, most are represented by public defenders who don't have resources at all, or certainly not resources to do that kind of investigation. So when they were able to reveal it, there was a referral to bar counsel, and he ended up being disbarred. And, fine, that's all well and good, but there are people who've been on death row because of, prosecutorial misconduct, and they've discovered that the prosecutors have engaged in that misconduct, hiding evidence, even affirmatively hiding it, and nothing has happened to those prosecutors. Nothing. I mean, they weren't referred to bar counsel. They certainly weren't prosecuted for anything. So, again, the race and class disparities in our criminal justice system just, exist in so many ways and at so many levels.
So, Professor Davis, I now totally understand that the disciplinary process is inadequate and that the legal profession has failed to discipline an unethical prosecutor. So what kind of reforms do you suggest?
So that's the part of my research I'm still struggling with. I've gone through so many stages of, what do we do about this problem? So I think it's a multifaceted approach. I think, first of all, we need to strengthen the disciplinary process for prosecutors. We need to, first of all, the rules of professional responsibility, the rules themselves need to be stricter. They need to be stronger for prosecutors. But we also need to make the process one that's easier, and we need to have more people make referrals to bar counsel, and we need those bar counsels to take those referrals seriously, and there are a number of different ways that can happen. I mean, one of the problems, I think, and I mentioned earlier, is that anyone can make a bar referral. It doesn't have to even be a lawyer. Anyone who can go to their local bar counsel and report that a prosecutor has engaged in misconduct. But the reality is that the people who are most likely to become aware of the misconduct are going to be the defense attorney and the judge because they're involved in the case. I mean, unfortunately, because there's so little transparency, it's oftentimes hard for even defense attorneys or judges to discover it because so many of these decisions are made behind closed doors. But when they are discovered by the defense attorney and the judge, as I said before, they're not making the referrals. The judges, I don't know why they do. I've talked to a lot of judges about this. Why aren't you making the referrals? I even had one judge to say to me, well, I don't want to ruin the prosecutor's life. And I tell you, I was all I could do not to scream. I try to be respectful of judges, but it was all I could do not to just scream at this judge. Like, are you kidding me? Ruin his life when he's about to put someone in prison for the rest of their life? Whose life is being ruined here, right? But I think the problem is that there, a lot of times there's a very cozy relationship between the judge and the prosecutor in these cases. Some prosecutors appear before the same judges over and over again in the same courtroom. They have a relationship with them. They become friendly. A lot of judges are former prosecutors. And so I think that oftentimes there's a bias there towards the prosecutor on the part of judges, and so they don't make the referrals. There are some judges who do. Judge Emmett Sullivan in the United States District Court for the District of Columbia is famous. He handled the Ted Stevens case, the Senator Stevens case. He is famous for referring judges, for referring prosecutors to bar counsel, and not just in the Ted Stevens case, in lots of cases, because he takes it seriously. But there are very few judges who do. As far as the defense attorney is concerned, a lot of times defense attorneys don't want to make the referral because it's one of those things, like, you know, the old saying, if you shoot at the king, you better kill him, or I think that's, maybe I'm paraphrasing.
I think that's it.
It's like, okay. But that's kind of what's going on here, because if you've got a defense attorney who has to deal with the same prosecutor for all of his cases, if he refers that prosecutor to bar counsel, he's never going to get another good deal for his client. The prosecutor, because again, the prosecutor's got all this discretion when making plea offers. They could just be vindictive and decide, oh, we're not going to give him a good plea because his client's good pleas because he's referring us to bar counsel. So they're kind of afraid to make the referral too. So it's a difficult process. So we need to strengthen that process. The other way that I think we need to solve this, and this is what I've been working on most recently, is I mentioned earlier that the vast majority of prosecutors on the state level are elected officials. We just need to elect some good people as prosecutors, right? How about electing a progressive person who understands mass incarceration and wants to do something about it, who understands racial disparities and wants to do something about it? How about electing someone like that to be the prosecutor and let's see what happens? And it's starting to happen across the country. People are starting to pay attention to prosecutors. I'll give you one example. There's a man named Larry Krasner, who is the district attorney for Philadelphia. Larry Krasner, who happens to be a white man, by the way, was elected to be the district attorney in Philadelphia back in 2016. I think he started in 2017. And Larry was a former defense attorney. He went after bad cops. He sued. You know, he was someone who was on the side of making it the criminal justice system. He ran for the district attorney, and he won. He won with the support of the Black Lives Matter movement and African Americans, and Philly is a predominantly black city, but he got their support because they knew that he was going to, you know, turn things around, and he has been doing phenomenal things as a prosecutor. He came in there, he fired about 30 people because they decided that they were not with the progressive program, so he said, okay, bye, you can find another job. And he's hiring progressive people. He issued a memo to his prosecutors telling them line by line, and all this is on, your listeners can find all this online if they just Google Larry Krasner. The memo he issued is actually available online as well, where he instructed them that they were not permitted to ask for more than a certain amount of time for certain offenses, that they are not to prosecute certain cases. He stopped prosecuting certain cases. He's having creating areas where people who are addicted will not be prosecuted at all, will not even be arrested. He is changing the bail situation where people are not being held on bail because they simply can't afford to pay. There's a long list of things that he's doing that are just tremendously radical and wonderful things to turn around the criminal justice system in Philly, because he's got the power and discretion to do it, and he's using it in a way to make positive change. Kim Fox is another example. She's an African-American woman who was elected in Chicago, and boy, Chicago's situation is terribly difficult. But she is also a progressive prosecutor who came in, asked the judge basically to release all these folks who were being held pretrial for minor offenses because they couldn't afford to make bond. She's had told, you know, transparency is the rule there. She's opening up her office and revealing and publishing statistics about charging and other decisions that are being made in the office, and a host of other progressive reforms. And there are others as well. So I'm very hopeful about that. The ACLU, an organization called Color of Change, there are other organizations who are doing this big educational sort of campaign to educate people about the power of prosecutors and urging people to pay attention to district attorney races. So I have some hope that if we can get more progressive people to take over those offices and get people to pay attention to these races, that we can make change that way as well. You know, when I was growing up, whoever the person was that nobody else liked, that's the person I wanted to help. That's just me. And so, of course, you know, someone who's charged with a crime in the criminal justice system, they need help more than anyone else. I was so proud to stand next to my clients in the courtrooms in the District of Columbia and require the government to respect them, you know, and defend them against the mighty power of the government. I always took great pride in that, no matter what my clients were charged with. And so I feel like that work was probably the most important work that I've ever done or ever will do. I love being a law professor. I love writing. But the work as a public defender, particularly in the D.C. Public Defender Service, which I think is the best defender service in the country, it was just, I think, some of the best work I've ever done. And I would encourage I encourage my law students. I encourage them actually to be prosecutors if they're going to be progressive about it, but I also obviously encourage them to be public defenders as well, because I think it's God's work, and I'm proud of the time that I spent doing that work.
How can listeners follow you and your work, Angela?
Well, I have the website for my latest book is policingtheblackman.com. They can go to that website and learn not only about the book, but about me and my work. And also at the Washington College of Law's website, there's a lot about the work that I do as well, there as well.
It's really been wonderful having you on Law and Disorder. I read both Arbitrary Justice, and I'm in the middle of reading Policing the Black Man. I congratulate you for your good work, and thank you again for being on our radio show, and I hope you'll come back.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation.
You take it easy.
All right. Take care.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.